Hi, everybody. I'm Patricia. I'm an alcoholic. Billy, thank you for asking me to be here. And you never know who you're going to run into, right, Lynn? Lynn and I saw each other, and we both said, oh, my God. We had breakfast together 6 years ago at a convention down in Richmond. Richmond, right? Richmond. But anyway, I'm really glad to be here. Thank you so much for asking me. And I was thinking this afternoon, when I first got here, the old timers would always say, don't forget where you came from or you're doomed to repeat it. And that is the gift of being asked to speak, because you really get that shot in the face of, boy, I was out of control, or, boy, I was really spiritually lost, is more like it for me. And my sobriety date is April 25th, 1993. I have a home group and a sponsor. And to the best of my ability, I try to do on a daily basis the basic fundamental things we learn to do here to stay sober, and I try to do that. Some days I'm better at it than other days, but I just keep trying. And in my home group where I got sober, there was an old-timer, and he used to say, he was real big on always saying, your life will become beyond your wildest dreams. And he always used to say, join AA and see the world, because he never traveled till he got sober. So I figured today, join AA and see the world. Well, Madison's in the world, so I'm glad to be here. And I love going to meetings in a town that I've never been to before, and I love people, and I love meeting different people in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I was very excited to come down here this week. And what it was like, what happened, and what it's like for me today. And I come from a big Irish Catholic blue-collar Teamster family up in New York. And five kids in 7 years, one right after the other. And alcoholic mother, hard-working, always having three jobs father. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I walked through these doors, everything was God and my mother's fault. And everything they did was wrong. And then I took a little journey through the steps for the first time, and boy, didn't that change my old ideas. And one of the things that I'm extremely grateful for having grown up in the family that I grew up in, is there was always, no matter what was going on, there was always a lot of laughing. And dinner table was like a circus, and I was the ringleader. And I must have learned at a very early age, with all these kids in this tiny little apartment, God bless my mother, she didn't drive. In the house with these kids, all these kids, and she babysat for another one, too. And I was the one that figured out, and I must have figured this out at a very early age with all these kids, it was very hard to get attention. And I figured out the way for me to get attention was to be the funny one. But the funny one is the one who's always getting in trouble. There's definitely a connection there. So is the funny one so busy entertaining, and the funny one goes across the line all the time and then has to be put in their place. And everyone in my family has an excellent, excellent sense of humor. And I'm really proud to be from that family. And when I first got here, if you told me, Patricia, in X amount of years you're going to say something like that, I would have said, no way, I will never say anything like that. And it's funny, because when I came to AA, I would go to meetings, I would see the steps, the screens on the walls, and I'd be looking at the steps, and all I ever heard people talk about was four and how dreadful it was. And I said, the hell with four, look at nine. And I said, I'm going to have to apologize to my mother. And they said, Patricia, you're on one, don't look past it. You're just on one, that's all you need to worry about. And one of the prayers I prayed when I first got here, as much anger, resentment, hatred I had for my mother when I got here, one of the things I did pray for when I saw 9, and I would sit in meetings, step meetings, and they'd be on the 9th step, I would just, something in me would say, God, please don't let anything happen to my mother before I get to the 9th step. Because I knew when I got here and I heard you people talk, and I listened in step meetings, I knew my life would never be right without that 9th step. And we'll get to the 9th step. But grew up in this house, and 3 girls, 2 boys, Catholic school, church twice a week, religious instructions 24 hours a day. And we grew up, we had very nice nuns. They never hit us like all these stories you hear about. And it was grades 1 through 8. And in the 7th grade was when I started getting a little cocky. So the 7th grade nun was always calling my mother, telling her, your daughter's talking back to me. In my house, you feared the wrath of Rosie Coons, my mother. When my mother said something, it went. And when you were in trouble, you were in trouble. And there was no, my father was the laid back one, and she was the disciplinarian. And when she dished something out, it stuck. There was no, oh, Dad, could you please talk to her? And I was the only kid of 5 that would not play the peace at any price thing. Because from a very early age, I had strong opinions on everything, and I was going to let you know what my opinions were. Those opinions got me in a lot of trouble. And I'm always amazed, the longer I stay sober, and I'm sitting in meetings, especially when we get to the 12-step meeting, and I said, practicing these principles in all our affairs, and I said, isn't it funny, in my case, practicing these principles in all my affairs 90% of the time involves keeping my mouth shut. That's why I love that tradition. It's 10, I think, right? No opinions on outside issues. That one's helped me tremendously. I can have opinions. You guys just don't need to know them all the time. And anyway, so there was a lot of laughing, and that's what I loved about drinking. When I discovered alcohol, it enhanced my comic abilities. And I just loved laughing. I still love laughing. When I was sent to Alcoholics Anonymous by a shrink, one of my biggest fears getting sober was, what if nothing is funny anymore? Like anything had been funny for years. But I was so terrified that I would never have those belly laughs and all that laughing, like carrying on like you would have in a bar. I have never laughed so much in my life as I have since getting sober, because now the laughing's real. It's real, and I love it. And sense of humor is a tremendous tool for dealing with life on life's terms. And one thing that the steps and you people have taught me, that I love that rule about don't take yourself so seriously, and to stay long enough to have developed the ability to laugh at myself has been a tremendous gift. Because I would always laugh at you guys, but I was not able to truly laugh at myself in terms of accepting myself the way I was. And I went to Catholic school, and we were taught in that town, that school, whatever, we were taught about a punishing God, and we were scared of him. And in my house growing up, we had all the Madonna collection. My mother collected them, and that's the statue of Mary, the mother of God. We had lots of those, and we had that picture of Jesus on the wall that wherever you go in the room, it looks like he's either following you, try being 5 and having Jesus look. And so when we would go to Catholic school and they would say, Jesus is watching you, I'd be like, I know. He's in my living room. And so I was very afraid of Jesus. I was very afraid of God. And when I came here, I really believed that God wanted nothing to do with me. And my big part of my second step was, came to believe that God would care about me as much as he cared about you, because I believed he wanted nothing to do with me. So, I was very cutting edge in that Catholic school. My girlfriend and I were the first ones ever in the history of St. John the Evangelist in Mahopac, New York, to cut out of school. It wasn't my idea. I wasn't usually the one with the ideas, but I was one jumping on the bandwagon first. And we picked the week that my father was on vacation to cut out of school, and he's the one that found us. And there was hell to pay for that one. And that's at the age of 12 or 13. And I think about it now. I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and one of the first things I identified with was when a man in a meeting used to say all the time, alcoholism is a disease of loneliness. And I strongly identify. And when I heard that, when I came here, I felt like finally somebody knows how I feel. And I can see back to being a little kid, loving people, but still doing this, especially with the brothers and sisters. Like, you could be close to me for so long, but when I'm done, I'm done. I don't want you in my space anymore. And I was the only one of the kids in the house to want to isolate in the room. They were all perfectly happy, sitting in the living room, watching TV and stuff, and I don't want anything to do with that. Always wanted to just sit in the room with the rocking chair and listen to music. And music was the first drug of choice, shall we say, to get me out of my head, way before I picked up a drink. I was a very, very moody kid. And my mother used to say, we can't figure you out. What the hell is wrong with you? You're either way up here or way down here. There's never a happy medium with you. And I lived my whole life like that until AA and the steps taught me how to find balance. And I'll still go there, you know. But my poor parents, they had their handful, and we did have one sick child in the family, a brother with cystic fibrosis. And so my parents, my poor father working his three jobs, mother with the kids and working at a night job, and a sick kid. But my parents were very religious people. And the longer I'm sober, I cannot express how grateful I am to all the things that they taught us, especially how to treat people and how to respect people. And that's something I could never, ever repay my parents. I'm so grateful to have the parents that I had, to have grown up in the crazy house and grown up with an alcoholic mother. And I'm sure there are some of you that have an alcoholic parent you grew up with. And the scary thing was never knowing what to expect. Never knowing what the mood was going to be when you got home. And never knowing if you were going to be the golden child or the one on the outside. And it was crazy. And at the age of 16 was when I started getting really with my parents. And they took me out to dinner one night, and I couldn't figure out why they'd taken me and not the other kids. Well, they were at the end of their rope, and they said, we just don't know what to do with you anymore. Your moods are too off the hook, blah, 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 blah. Would you go see a therapist? And I said, yeah. If someone's going to listen to me talk about how rotten they are, I'll go. Give me my shot. So they threw me in therapy at the age of 16. And it was at the age of 16, I guess, that I had my first drunk. And as I like to say, I love speaker meetings. They're still my favorite. And I thought this was so funny when I first came to AA. Going to speaker meetings, and in the area of New York where I got sober, lot of speaker meetings. And we grew up on speaker meetings. And it's always so funny to me when you go to a speaker meeting and somebody's up here and they're telling the story about their first drunk. And I don't think, we used to call the people that weren't alcoholics in New York, we called them civilians. I don't think a lot of civilians even remember their first drunk, but put one of us up here, and the face comes on, and the light goes on, and it's like the greatest love story. I remember my first drunk. My parents used to drink Manhattans, and when I was about 8 and tasted it, I said, never drink. I'll never drink. I hated the taste. And my first drunk was, I was 16, I was a junior in high school, and we were at the seniors graduation party. We were drinking 7 and 7s. It was the 70s, and that's what everybody was drinking. Didn't have just a sip, didn't have just a drink, just drank it like it was soda. Hated the taste, loved what it did, because the thing, I could still see it in my mind like it was yesterday. The love affair has begun. That feeling of feeling less than that I knew I felt my whole life with that first drunk, all of it melted away. And I had gone through life up to that point where everybody else was here and I was here. And then I got drunk and it went like this. And I was the same as everybody else and I popped it. And the party was outside and the bathroom was inside upstairs. And I remember running up the stairs and it was like my feet weren't touching the ground and it was like flying up the stairs and I loved it. And I would venture to say I had at least 6 drinks, if not more, that night. Never drank one of anything. Still can't drink one of anything. Never, always still to this day, got to have 2 things going at once. It's got to be water and coffee or water and something. I can't, old habits die hard. I can't just drink one of anything still. And I loved that getting drunk. And I loved the feeling of feeling a part of something, because from a little person on, I always felt like I was on the outside looking in. And I'll say this, when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, being beat up after 17 years of drinking and coming through these doors, and you people all knew each other, and you were all hugging and laughing and talking, the feeling for me of being on the outside looking in was worse. So if anybody's new and you feel like that, that's exactly. And that fear of, I'm never going to feel like they feel. They're all so comfortable with each other. They're hugging each other, blah, 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 blah. And to watch you people hugging each other, that's what I wanted, and that's when you people had what I wanted. I just wanted someone to hug me like that. And you people were sitting. You would see some people either before the meeting, before everyone came in, or after. 2 might be sitting here, and maybe 2 sitting back there. And there might be 2 people sitting here, and 1's crying, and the other one sitting there holding their hand. And I wanted that so desperately. And that's why, for me, a big part of 12-step work for me is listening and holding somebody's hand. Because sometimes people just need someone to listen. They don't need to hear, well, you need to be on this step and rah, 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 rah. Human beings need somebody to just hear them. And I think for me that's very important. 12-step work is to just be a presence for somebody, be sitting in a chair in a meeting. And my drinking career, you guys were calling it a career when I got here, and I was so glad because I had been calling it that before I ever came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was no big deal. After that first drink, I wasn't obsessed with it. It wasn't a case of can't wait to do it again. There was probably a lot of Catholic guilt going on about it shouldn't have done that. Because there was always the nonstop battle of good and evil in my head. And as my disease progressed and my drinking got worse, and when I first came here, I would tell you people that I drank for 17 years. A lot of drugs, too, but nothing like the alcohol. I was able to leave the drugs alone. They just weren't the same thing. When I first got here, I would have told you because I thought that I drank for 12 of the 17 years on a daily basis. But the longer I stayed around and memory became clearer, at least 15 of those years were on a daily basis. And when my drinking progressed to drinking on a daily basis, I really didn't think it was a problem, having grown up in a house where there was daily drinking. My mother drank every day. So, but there was that little bit of, this guy on this shoulder is saying, Patricia, everybody drinks like you. And this guy on this shoulder saying, Patricia, nobody drinks like you. And it was that constant battle in my head. And when I came to AA, old timer said, Patricia, civilians don't get the kick in the heart when they take a drink like we do. I thought everybody felt like I did when they took a drink. What a shock that normal people don't get the automatic kick in the heart. I thought everybody did. That's why I couldn't understand why they could stop. I still don't understand that part. I also am fascinated by people telling their story and saying, I was drinking too much, and the wife was getting ready to leave, and the boss was going to fire me. So I looked up AA in the phone book, and I always think, where the hell did that come from? Where would anybody get the idea to call Alcoholics Anonymous? I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous, except that I didn't want to know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous, because somewhere along the line I heard, if you were an alcoholic and you knew it, you could never drink again. And that was people in AA, could never drink again. And when I would hear somebody say on a rare occasion that they were an alcoholic, I don't drink, I would send shoot up a quick prayer and say, God, please don't let that happen to me. Because the thought of going through life not drinking was pure terror and beyond my comprehension. And I say, those poor people have to go through life straight and deal with everything. And I said, that's never going to be me. So anyway, graduation day came, and I was probably the only person, Doug loves this story, in the class of 1976 without a plan. Because to me, it was still summer vacation. And I'll worry about it in the fall. And all these people are going to college and they're starting a job next week and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, was I supposed to have a plan? That is pretty funny. I mean, you think about these kids graduate today and how smart they are. I'm sure they got plans. I had no plan. Except I was 17, the drinking age was 18, but I was able to get in bars at the time with my mouth full of braces. But standing on that lawn outside the high school when all the parents are there and they're taking the pictures of the kids, it's hitting me that all these people know what they're going to do. Mind you, I'd only gotten drunk a couple times. It's not like I'm in my alcoholism yet. This is me not drinking. No plan. This disease was with me way before I picked up a drink. And that was the summer my disease took off. And it was 1976, and you had the discos, and you had the rock and roll bars. And what we would do would be we would go to the disco first to prep ourselves and get a good buzz. Then we would go to the rock places and finish it off. And last call was at 3, so you ordered 5 or 6, and then you just hung out there till the sun came up. And when I was brand new in Alcoholics Anonymous, and sitting in the meetings and listening to people, and it hit me all the times I drove drunk, and it was only God that kept me from killing somebody. And that freaked me out, because that should have been me sitting in some jail cell. But it wasn't, and I realized that was during, in the rooms where I got sober, there weren't really a lot of suggestions, they were more like instructions. And it was, you will do 90 meetings in 90 days. And it was in my 90 that I realized, how come I didn't kill anybody? And I had given up driving and drinking, not drinking, just the driving and drinking, probably 2 years before I got here, because I knew there was no way I could go out and not get 20 sheets to the wind. And I had this thing in my gut that I might kill somebody, so I better give up the driving. That, to me, is the grace of God, because I wasn't capable of that kind of thinking. But the summer of 76, no plan, staying out till 5, 6, can't understand what my mother's getting so upset. She's just such a witch. I'm sleeping all day, and my justification is, what does she care? I have the door closed. And I can't understand what she's getting so upset about. And she can't understand why this kid ain't getting off her butt to get a job. So we're fighting and carrying on. So I said, you know what? I'll just leave. No plan, no money, no nothing. So I just left. And these were in the days of the Son of Sam in New York, blowing everybody away in Astoria, Queens. So I decided I'll go stay with friends in Astoria, Queens. Who wouldn't let me go to the bar with them at night. They made me stay home while they, because they were afraid that they would get blown away. And I was gone for some months, and right before I left, a couple months before all hell broke loose, I had a boyfriend, and that boyfriend was 19, I was 17, and he died of cancer. And 2 months later, my brother, the one that was sick, died from his cystic fibrosis. And those were rough days, because with my mother and her alcoholism and also severe mental illness, you didn't talk about this stuff in the house. So everybody just kept shoving it and shoving it and shoving it. So that's the point at which I can say my drinking really, really took off. And that was to be the case for 17 years. Got into the restaurant business. I didn't want to work a real job. How boring is that, sitting at a desk? I could never understand people that got up early in the morning, went to work, came home and cooked dinner, watched TV, and went to bed. Why would anybody want to live like that? And my big thing from, I think, the time I came out of the womb was I was always bored. Bored. No matter what, I was always bored. And in one of the meditation books, it talks, in one of the AA books, it talks about boredom being a big symptom of self-centeredness. And I'm happy to say, since I've been here, I have not been bored. And how could you be, listening to people's older stories? But anyway, I got into the restaurant business, and found people that drank like me, and people that thought like me, and people that were worse than I was, so I could say, see, I'm not that bad. They do a lot more drugs. And the drinking and the driving and the discos and the carrying on, and it was just crazy, and I don't regret any of it. And that was one of the things when I came here and I would hear the promises, I believed that they could all come true for me, except we will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it, because I was so full of shame and guilt and self-loathing when I got here that I thought, there's no way I'm ever going to be able to accept my past, my thinking in my past, behavior in my past, and it didn't come to pass for me, and I really didn't think I would ever be able to let go of stuff. But there's your fourth or fifth step. And my life was crazy. I was out of control, and I was getting tired. And I worked with a guy who was a recovered alcoholic, and he was a lot younger than I was. I was in my late 20s. The worst of my drinking was not the end of my drinking. I think only because my body couldn't handle the quantities of alcohol that I had handled early on. And for years, at least 10 years, drank a fifth of vodka a night, thinking there was absolutely nothing unusual about that. That wasn't even spread out over the course of a day. That was just at night. And I think about that now, and I'm like, imagine drinking all that poison in that few hours. I still can't get over that. And drinking started changing for me because my mood while I was drinking started changing, and I started changing. And where I had always been the funny, entertaining one, I started getting more irritated with people around me when I was drinking. And whatever I had shoved in there, because that's what I did, I just shoved any kind of negative feeling I felt, I shoved it into nope, so you would like me, and I would be happy and entertaining. Well, I couldn't keep up the front anymore. And people would drink with me, and where I used to be very funny and stuff, I started getting a little more sullen. And we'd be sitting in a bar, and I would just tune out. Or I would start getting nasty. And people would say, Patricia, we don't know what happens to you, but somewhere during the night, you cross the line, and you just become possessed. And that was the word they used. Because now, where I am with my disease mentally, where nothing's acceptable, no person, place, thing, especially myself, but I didn't know that till I came here and you people taught me that, everything's getting under my skin. And I don't feel like talking anymore. And if I'm going to talk, all I want to tell you is exactly what I think at the moment. I think I'm a New Yorker, and I'm going to let you know what I'm thinking, especially about your life and what you should be doing. So people would mention things like, do you think you're drinking too much? And I would pride myself for years that I never had a blackout. I never had to be told what I did the night before, so I'm not that bad. Well, that stuff started happening. And people would say things about my drinking, so my standard response was, if you have a problem with my drinking, don't drink with me. If you have a problem with my drinking, that's your problem, because I don't have a problem with my drinking. Vomiting on a daily basis was the norm for years. I couldn't go to bed and pass out till I threw up first. Always covered in black and blues from banging into things. You, to look at me, you would think that somebody was beating me. From the drinking, always in the doctor's office with stomach problems, and nobody of doctors and things ever asked me how much I was drinking, because to look at me, you wouldn't think that that was the problem. And so too many people started saying too many things about my drinking, so I said, screw y'all, I'll drink by myself. So that's what I did. And my life was about drinking, crying, hit a few walls on the way to bed, pass out. And the interesting thing was, one of the friends I worked with in the restaurant, he was a recovered alcoholic. He would drive me to my bars. How codependent is that? And I'd be drunk, and he'd be driving, and I'd say, Mark, how did you know when it was your time to stop? I wanted a definite answer so that I would know when it was time to stop. And I would say, Mark, how did you know? And he'd just drive, and he'd go, don't worry, Patsy, you'll know. And he used to piss me off when he would say that, because I wanted an answer like, X, Y, and Z will happen, then you'll know you're done. But that, he wouldn't tell me that. He'd just say, you'll know, Patsy. So anyway, I'm drinking, crying, falling apart, and nobody knows how much I'm drinking. And now this mood that I had is becoming my constant mood when I'm not drunk. Nobody was acceptable to me. I was in a constant state of absolute irritation, fear to not being able to sleep with the light out for at least 2 years. Now, in addition to God, I'm terrified of the devil and this obsession with the devil at night. And I was absolutely terrified. I never slept. And I would go to work, and I wouldn't drink during the day because I knew if you drank during the day, that meant you had problems. So I have a problem because I don't drink during the day. And I became born again 2 years before I got here. So here I am trying to live this style of life. I'm trying to be this good Christian, and I can't stop drinking, and I know Jesus wants me to stop drinking, and it's all too hard. It's too hard being good anymore, and it's too hard being bad anymore, and I'm just... I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and one of the words that I hear in a meeting when somebody says it, whether they're up here or sitting there, that I hang on the edge of my seat when I hear the word despair. Because that was the overwhelming, nonstop feeling for me when I came here and had been for years. Looking down that black hole, never resigning myself to, I'm just going to be a sick drunk, and this is the way my life's going. And nothing will ever work out. And I didn't expect to live to 30, and I didn't want to live past that either. And I would beg up, please, Kate, take me, please. And I would wake up in the morning, and I'd be begging them, just get me. Just come and get me and take me home, because you really can't live like this. And when I think that, by the grace of God, I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous, I see that as an answer to a prayer that I had prayed for years. Please help me. I can't live like this. But in praying those prayers, I was expecting God to personally come down and fix my life and fix whatever was wrong and set me straight and help me lose the craziness. I didn't realize till you guys told me that there's such this little part called footwork. And that I had to do my part, and then God would do his part, but I didn't think I had to do a part. And I will say, one of the big things that I drank over for years was a great excuse to drink was, at the age of 21, having had a baby and given the baby up for adoption. And I was 21 when I had her, and I was 34 when I got here, and all those years could never connect that I had a part in getting myself in that situation. And when I came here and I started working those steps and I did that first fourth step, it so reeked of self-pity all over that I couldn't even touch that paper. And it was in my first year of sobriety, sitting in a meeting, that light went off, that it was all about my disease of alcoholism and my irresponsibility that got me in the situation of having to give a child up for adoption. And, you know, when you're new and all those light bulbs are going off and it's like, oh. Because when I got here, I told you everything was God and my mother's fault. And the people in AA was just looking at me and laugh. And through a major spiritual experience, I went to a therapist who, after talking to me for 5 minutes, said in her New York shrink way, face it, you're an alky. And my ego went nuts, and I said, who the hell is she calling an alky? And it wasn't about my ego going nuts, it was about sheer terror. Because if she's telling me that I'm an alky, and she's a professional, I like therapists, I have always gotten help from therapists. Therapy has always worked for me. I hear a lot of people say it didn't work, it has always worked for me. And I don't think I'd be sober just on AA alone without the other work that, and the other help I've had to get. But when I had walked through her door, because I had called this clinic and said, I think I might have a problem with alcohol, they said, can you come tomorrow? I said, no, I can come next week. I called on a Monday. They said, can you come tomorrow? I said, I can come next Monday, because that would have another weekend in there. Like, if weekend made any difference. It didn't matter if it was Monday or Saturday I was drinking. And that therapist's name was Gracie. So there's the beginning of my realization of the grace in my life. And when she said, face it, you're an alkie. After I got over the shock, and the shock was because there was that little bit of hope before I walked through her door that it might not be alcoholism. If she said, you're crazy, that would be fine, because that would mean I could still drink being crazy. And for me, when she said that, it was like sitting in a room with four brick walls, and every brick came down at once, and life was over. No more alcohol. If she's saying alcoholic, that means no more alcohol. And my heart was about to explode, like, oh my God, it's happening to me. But at the same time, if Gracine had said, Patricia, go across the street and get on that building and jump off 9 floors and the craziness in your head and the hurting in your heart will stop, I would have done it. I was so beat up, especially mentally, very beat up physically, but mostly mentally and extremely spiritually, that I was willing to do whatever she said. And when she said, I'm putting you in the outpatient program, I said, great. That means someone's going to take care of me, because I was very tired. I was very sick, and I just wanted someone to take care of me. Then when she said, and you're going to Alcoholics Anonymous, I said, I remember going like this, I said, do you really think that's necessary? And I couldn't see that I was manipulating alcoholic, right? I said, do you really think that's necessary? And her chair had wheels on it. She rolled herself over. She put her nose up to my nose, and she said, you don't have a choice, because you keep drinking the way you're drinking, you're going to die. And I'm thinking, it's only alcohol. We're not talking heroin here. It's just alcohol. And she said something to me that scared me. She said, do not stop drinking until I talk to a medical doctor first. Because for how much you've been drinking and how long you've been drinking it, you could go into seizures and die by going cold turkey. And I thought, from alcohol? I didn't know this stuff. I don't know if you guys knew this stuff, but I did not know this stuff, and it scared me. And the stuff I saw in the films, in outpatient, did help me, because they scared me. When they said the consistency of your blood trying to work its way through your brain when you're drunk is that of sludge. I said, sludge. That scared me, and I'll tell you what. When I came to my first meetings, those first couple weeks, I was not one of the people that came to their first meeting and never drank again. I would come, go a day, had to drink again. I would come again the next day, go 2 days, drink again, and I couldn't stop doing it because I was so anxious and so wound up. But what I did was I made sure I told the people in my program, and I told the people in AA, I drank again. But between the sludge incident and the people in the therapist saying, okay, let's make a deal. If you drink again, you promise to go inpatient. And that really scared me, and I never drank again. Because I don't want to lose what little I had, apartment job, all that stuff, and that's what I was afraid of. And I came in to the hardcore big book thumping, totally taking it serious AA in New York. Those people were about saving lives. And still these years later, when I'm on my knees at night and thanking God almost every single night, I remember to say, thank you for seeing fit for me to get sober where I got sober, because you know what? I needed people in my face calling me on every single little thing. Every time you turn around, somebody was calling. I said, will these people ever give us a break? And these sponsors were tough. And they were going to the pigeons' houses, going through their stuff, dumping their alcohol. They were pulling out your alcohol t-shirts out of your drawers. Or you won't need this anymore. And what I heard in meetings over and over and over again is, one way or another, this thing is going to kill you. If you're lucky, it'll kill you fast. Chances are it won't. And you'll die, and it'll be a long, miserable death. And they didn't want to hear anything that us newcomers had to say. And they said, we know how to get drunk. Why don't you learn how to get sober? And they all take the cotton out of your ears and stick it in your mouth. And we got service positions immediately. And we had to mop the floor. And the old-timers would bust our chops by standing in the meeting for an hour after it was over so we couldn't mop the floor. And we couldn't say anything either. We just had to wait. They were about teaching us some humility. But you know what? As rough as they were, they loved us. And they took care of us. And the home groups met 3 nights a week, and you joined one immediately because they grilled you on what your home group was. And you got a service position immediately. And when you did your 90 meetings in 90 days, you were allowed to drive to your home group meeting, but on the nights that the home group didn't meet, you went on commitments. And everybody would meet at the church where your home group met, and there were two or three drivers, the older members, and they would take all of us newcomers to our meetings in our 90s, so we never had to worry about where we were going to be. They totally took care of us. And they kept saying things like, just let us love you till you can love yourself.
Big tough guy saying stuff like that.
Big tough guy saying, Patricia, I have days where I hate myself and I can't look in the mirror. I didn't know men felt like that. I didn't know men were just as afraid of life as I was. But these guys weren't afraid to let you know. And I never felt so a part of something in my life as I did when I came to alcohol. Because I was never embraced for just plain old broken, messed up me, as the people in Alcoholics Anonymous just accepted me. And any kind of hardline stuff, and getting in the face or whatever, it was all about saving my life. And they were sitting up with people till 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning when they had to go to work the next day. And people were calling them and they were running out the door to be with them. And like I said before, that hand-holding, that just got me. I just wanted someone to hold on to me. And that feeling of, would that squirrel cage go? And for 1 hour, I knew I was going to be safe. And for 1 hour, even if I was, and in those days, in those meetings, there were no 6, 7, 7:30 p.m., only 8:30s. As Doug likes to call them, standard drunk time. And you would wait all day long, no matter how bad of a day you were having. But the gift in that was it forced you to use phone. Yeah. And they made such a big deal when you celebrated your 90 days. And when you celebrated your year, you would have thought that it was the biggest thing that ever happened in these people's lives. They just were so happy. And they would say at anniversaries, they would celebrate once a month, the last Friday of the month in my home group. And everybody that had an anniversary would celebrate. And they would always say at the beginning of the meeting, It's not just a celebration of the celebrant, it's a celebration of life over death. And they would say it all the time. And I have always been fortunate enough to have exactly the sponsors that have worked perfectly for me and with me. And I've always had sponsors that have been painfully honest and tough with me and loving at the same time. Sponsors who are more than happy to hold up the mirror, because when I came here, it was all this. And they said, hold up, Patricia, here's the mirror. You might want to look in here, because this is where the problem is. And I'm saying, it can't be me. It's got to be all them. And you know what? I wasn't afraid of that. Everyone's talking about that fourth step and being afraid. I knew I had so much stuff in there that needed to come out. And if AA was giving me a chance to take it, I was taking it. And I was in a fifth step meeting in my home group a couple weeks ago. And I was thinking about how blessed I've been in all of my fifth steps, that the sponsors have been honest about what they've seen. And some fifth steps are easier than others. And the ones that get harder are the ones a little farther down the line, when I'm thinking the glaring character defect is going to be this. And they say, oh no, Patricia, it's this. And it's like, It's taken me years of sobriety to be able to accept myself, and especially to be able to accept that these character defects are me, are a part of me. Because I spent my whole life before I got here, and many years in sobriety, beating myself up for imperfections. And the arrogance of, it's okay for all of you to be imperfect, but not for me. I could not get that connection for years. That's pure arrogance. And this is the stuff they taught us, which made no sense. Coming to Alcoholics Anonymous up there for me was like coming to fourth level advanced French and never having taken the first course. Everything they said, I was like, what are they talking about? I'd have everything explained to me in simple terms. And the one funny thing that was, when we would go on the outgoings to the other meetings, the old timers would say, shut up and get in the car. So when we would go to meetings, I'd be looking at the slogans and I'm like, where's that other slogan? And they said, what other slogan? I said, the one that says shut up and get in the car. And I thought for years that that was a real slogan. In my experience, it was a real slogan. But the last thing I want to say is, I can't say enough about, fellowship is nice. The fellowship does not keep me sober. You people show me what I need to do. You might want to point something out to me. It is the steps and that relationship with God as I understand Him, and I see Him as Father. And He disciplines me when I need it. And He gives me my free will, because He loved me enough to let me make mistakes so that I'll need Him more. And I'll need you people more. And when I came to AA, I realized immediately, why am I sitting here, or any of us tonight, sitting in this room, and we all say we're drunks, and we all have these stories, so how come nobody's drinking? No human power can relieve my alcoholism. But the God of my understanding is the only source of power that can relieve my alcoholism. And the one thing that I try to keep up front above everything else is grace. And you hear a lot of people say it, but I think, are you thinking about it? Grace is an undeserved gift of a father for a daughter who did not deserve it. Or the life I have today. People say, I earned my seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. Grace gave me my seat in Alcoholics. I didn't earn anything. The grace of God, I think about it when I'm walking down the street, when I'm sitting in a meeting, when I'm sitting home. I'm like, I just get, like, how could you love us that much? Because I'm a human being, I don't love like that. I want to love like that, but I don't have the capacity to love the way God loves His children. And it blows my mind. And I pray that I will always keep grace up front. I did not deserve it, and God said, that's enough, Patricia. I'm not going to just give you another shot. I'm going to give you a whole new life. And I pray, one day at a time, that I never see fit to throw grace back in God's face and say, I got this thing. How could you not be grateful if you really thought about it as a gift of grace? I don't earn it. And I thought God wanted nothing to do with me when I got here. Shows you what I know. Thanks for letting me share.